Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Ghibliotheque, the podcast that comes out of retirement to review new films by the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm the boy.
So join us in our glorious quest into the world of Studio Ghibli. Jake, Steph, first time in 3+ years, or nearly 3 years, a new Ghibli film we're reviewing on the podcast. How are we feeling?
Well, I suppose it's pretty monumental that it's not just a new Ghibli film. Since the inception of the podcast, it's the first Hayao Miyazaki film to come out. And The Wind Rises was fairly recent history when we began, and we thought that was the end of the book, that the last book on the Ghibliotheque shelf had been placed. And now, 10 years after the release of that, we're coming back. We've cracked open the doors once again. We found another tome on the shelf. It's a pretty exciting day. It's a pretty exciting time, I think, for Ghibli fans around the world.
And of course, Steph, is this the first time you're on reviewing a Ghibli film?
I think it is.
Because way back when, we didn't have you on. You only came into the fold on the microphone, at least, for Con onwards, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I've been absorbing all of you guys' Ghibli chat, watching all the films behind the scenes with you, but never on mic for a Ghibli film. So, yeah, this is exciting. Exciting to talk about
This is the Wizard of Oz moment. You've been behind the curtain pulling all the strings as this intimidating force that we've just spoken about in the Ghibliotheque. And now she's coming plundering in, pulling her pulleys and levers.
That timeline, Jake, is quite wild to consider because, yes, 10 years since The Wind Rises, 5 years since we started the podcast. Mm. So it's almost like these equal chunks of time leading up to today.
The start of the podcast is closer to the release of The Wind Rises than we are now to the release of the podcast.
This is a wanna feel old moment.
And I do.
And so it falls to us to record an episode. And as we did for the entire library of Ghibli films previously, we have to deliver the cohesive, comprehensive, authoritative view on this film, which is no mean feat. So I think we're going to do this a little differently to how we've done previous episodes. We did toy with doing a no marketing Toshio Suzuki episode, which is in reference to the fact that this film was released in Japanese cinemas with just a poster and nothing else. However, that would have just been probably an episode title in your podcast feed, 0 seconds long. But the way we're going to do it this time is we're going to do a sort of standard episode, standard length, harking back to the old days of the podcast where we have synopsis, context, review. But that review is going to be more of a light pebble skim across the film. Not necessarily first reactions, but immediate reactions. And then we're going to come back and then really relax, get a couple of drinks, settle in for an hour plus and go deeper and deeper into the film. And then I think maybe, which in the new year, I think it'd be great to revisit again, because the thing, none of us have seen the dub yet. So there's so much still to talk about with this film. But at least today, listeners, I guess as well what makes this tricky is that this film has had a very staggered release internationally. Maybe you saw it at the London Film Festival, Toronto Film Festival. Maybe you've seen it at some of the previews that have been up and down the country in the UK. Maybe you're in France and it's already sold 1.3 million tickets and you've seen it many times. Maybe you're in Japan where it's been a box office hit. It's come out in previews and coastal releases in America. In the UK, there are previews through December, but the actual release is Boxing Day. So it's a tricky one. So, but listeners, maybe you're saving yourself for that big watch, which is fine. This podcast will still be here when you've watched it. But if you have watched it, there is this episode to dive into, I suppose. I've not had to say this for a long time, but Steph, can you please tee things up with a little synopsis for us?
I'm happy to. So here we go. This is the very poetic synopsis from the G-Kids website landing page for the film. So a young boy named Mojito, yearning for his mother, ventures into a world shared by the living and the dead. There, death comes to an end and life finds new beginning. A semi-autobiographical fantasy about life, death and creation in tribute to friendship from the mind of Hayao Miyazaki.
Okay, Michael. So in terms of context sections, previously in Ghibliotech episodes, there's been a couple of years tops between releases, sometimes just a few months between those releases, getting us from one point in Ghibli history to the next. And you had about 15, 20 minutes to cover that period. How do you feel about covering 10 years of Ghibli history in that same period of time?
You know, I'm going to try. A decade is quite a landscape to traverse. A funny thing to do would have been, we could have done previously on Ghibliotech, bits from the Wind Rises context, the Earwig and the Witch context, the Neverending Man documentary episode that we did, all these episodes where we've talked about what Hayao Miyazaki has been up to, this retirement that wasn't really a retirement. But that last film I mentioned, Neverending Man, is key because that's a documentary that came out around 2016. And it documented the making of Borrow the Caterpillar, the Ghibli Museum short, where it was first revealed to the world that Miyazaki wasn't fully retired after The Wind Rises, where they shut up shop at the studio. And I think it's in that film as well where he sort of says, and maybe I'll make a feature as well, guys, with that amount of chipper feeling behind him. But we do find out now that actually it was halfway through 2016 that he started writing proposals for what this new feature film may be. In the G-Kids press notes, they've translated parts of that proposal. It's quite a downer, but I'll read some of it where Miyazaki's writing, there's nothing more pathetic than telling the world you'll retire because of your age and then making yet another comeback. Is it truly possible to accept how pathetic that is and do it anyway? Doesn't an elderly person deluding themselves that they're still capable despite their geriatric forgetfulness prove that they're past their best? You bet it does. Then he continues, it's all very well to drag in others and cause a heap of trouble yet still finish a film, but it's also entirely possible that you could become bedridden or die come crunch time. The instigator himself might be fully prepared for that, but for those who end up burdened with an incomplete film, it would be unbearable. Feature-length films take at least 3 years to complete. I could do one in a year when I was in my 40s, but now I'm 75. It's a lot to get done in 3 years. So he was clearly worrying not just about what sort of film to make, but whether he could even do it, whether he could finish it, whether there'd even be an audience for it. He was thinking, like, what would the world even look like in 3 years' time? And, of course, it took longer than 3 years, didn't it? But in 2017... that's when production starts in earnest, and there was a lot of buzz at the time. I remember when people found job listing posts saying, do you want to come and work for Studio Ghibli? And it was like freaking out, saying, what's this about? And then in October of that year, Toshio Suzuki actually announces the film and he reveals the title, which was, at least in the, for the Japanese release, How Do You Live? And that's the title taken from a book by Genzaburo Yoshino, which Miyazaki was familiar with and rediscovered later in life and was inspired by. Not so much, we found out, by the content of the book, but the title. The idea of a title like that really... Well, we've said before, haven't we, that the marketing copy and the taglines for Miyazaki films are sometimes just live, or the themes are like, how do we live in this world that's decaying around us? So I guess it's the ultimate Miyazaki move to actually make the title be How Do You Live? Although, you know, it's not really an adaptation. People did rush to then pick up the book, and it's a book from the 1930s.
People, but, including us.
Including us. Well,
and we all very much read it and speculated about how he could possibly be adapting this thing.
It's so funny. Everybody now says, well, really, if you read the actual announcement, it never said it was an adaptation. But everybody, including publishers, translators, Neil Gaiman, everybody around the world, we've got our copies of How Do You Live, which came out in English. And it actually says, you know, soon to be a film by Hayao Miyazaki. And reading back on the Neil Gaiman introduction for that is where he's just sort of vibing on the book, saying, how could this be a Miyazaki film? Turns out it wasn't ever going to be a Miyazaki film. But that's fascinating. I can't think of any other flex in filmmaking world where someone could just say, I'm making a film and it's called Winnie the Pooh or something. I don't like to take the title of a book and then everybody goes wild. And he's like, oh no, I was just inspired by the title of Winnie the Pooh.
Feels like the equivalent of when... film productions leave fake scripts in bins and stuff to like throw people off the scent so nobody actually knows what they're actually doing.
It does make me think of this, sorry, entirely different, but there's a Long Day's Journey into Night, the by Gann film, and that has nothing to do with the Eugene O'Neill play, but it's just,
yes,
like, we're just gonna call it that.
But I suppose when it's a new filmmaker or it's a something like that, you wouldn't necessarily think it. But when it's Miyazaki, who is somebody who is reads loads of literature, has adapted lots of literature in the past, of course everyone's going to rush to figure that out. In fact, and this is something that I think maybe now in the future, once the film's out, people will dig deeper into, he was more inspired by an English language book called The Book of Lost Things by John Connolly, which has actual plots and lore and world and thematic connections with the film. But that's something that has been sort of lost in the cacophony around the actual title of the film in Japan. But anyway, the original plan when Suzuki announced it was that the film would come out for the 2020 Olympics. And spoiler alert, guys, it didn't work out that way. And the difference this time compared to previous Miyazaki films is that, you know, this is his chance to be descended from a giant sloth, which is the phrase he used about Takahata, how he was not beholden to deadlines very much. And on this film, they really were taking their time. Dates kept slipping. And we've definitely mentioned that many times. And particularly, we've trotted out that quote, I think was from Suzuki, where at one point they were finishing maybe 1 minute of animation per month. And Jake, you always would say, you know, how long that would take to make a feature film. Some ungodly amount of time. But time passed and we'd hear bits and bobs about what the film's about, and it would be really interesting because every time there'd be a new press release or an article, I remember there was a big feature in the New York Times in 2021, there'd be another wave of people saying, he's come out of retirement, finally! And everyone just turns into goldfish online, basically. They forget that he's been working on this for a long time and we've known. But anyway, we hear bits and bobs about what the film's about and how it's working, and there's that quote that does the rounds that Suzuki gives where he says that Miyazaki's making this film for his grandson as a way of saying grandpa is moving on to the next world soon, but he is leaving behind this film, which I guess sort of plants this seed that it is a gift to future generations, maybe a swan song, maybe a final grand statement, even though, again, no one has ever said it would be his final film. And we now know that he's not retired after this film. He's still working hard. But in that time period, God, you know, in the time that he's working on this, there's so much that's happened. And, you know, sort of we could do that very online thing of many things that have happened in world history in the time that it took Miyazaki to make one film. But simple, hot, you know, sad things like Isao Takahata passing away in 2018 happened. Very happy things internationally, like in the in 2020 with the huge Netflix and HBO Max streaming deal, meaning that the films were more available than ever and had the chance to get this sort of global awareness and attention that they hadn't really been able to have previously. And I guess that deal is quite important because it's been mentioned that that big sale, the amount of money that they got from that, allowed Ghibli to fully finance this film themselves as an independent production. If you watched any previous Ghibli films, there'd be a lot of hyphens and ampersands on the copyright or on that sort of production notice that comes up at the beginning, because they'd have this production committee. All sorts of people would be co-financing and co-producing the film together. This was an independent production. And I guess that allows them to take their time and not hit any deadline.
It makes me think of Megalopolis, the Francis Ford Coppola film that we might be getting next year, who knows, but that he cashed in all his vineyard money and to raise the budget for that film to make it all himself and make it exactly the way that he wants to. I mean, the prospect of essentially just handing this over to Miyazaki with no commercial burden is amazing. And,
exactly.
And essentially betting the entire catalogue of the studio on the success of this is quite an amazing move.
Absolutely. And if you take Suzuki at his word, this is the most expensive Japanese film ever made. And I guess that's only because production took so long on it. They had to finance however many years, 2017 to 2023, had to finance 5-6 years of active production. Probably took a lot of money there. But we did wonder if we'd ever get a chance to see this film as time passed. And that all changed on the 13th of December 2022, which is my birthday, when they released the poster. They announced the release date, July 2023. The poster was this very confounding, strange graphic of a hand-painted bird man thing. I remember exactly where I was when I saw this post on the Ghibli Twitter account. I was sitting in the school hall waiting for my kids' nursery Christmas show to begin. Do you two remember where you were? Do you remember what you thought when you saw this poster for the first time?
No, I don't. But I remember talking on the podcast and saying that I thought it looked like a dragon. But I don't remember seeing it for the first time. But I remember because it's so vague, that image. Like, and I mean, even in the film, like that bird man thing is multifunction and changes shape all the time. So I could kind of see how I got a dragon from it. But yeah, amazing that something without that much direction to it would continue to be the only bit of marketing, really.
Yeah. Steph, what do you think? Because it had the title, How Do You Live, as well. So
yeah.
It didn't even have the title that it became known as The Boy and the Heron. So like, what do you even think looking at that poster?
I think, unlike Jake's wild imaginings of whatever it was on the poster, I think it read very bird to me. but I was excited. I don't really remember where I was. Like, yeah, I feel like this poster has been out for ages and it's all we saw for a really long time. But excitement, the kind of hand-drawn element of the poster, was very exciting to me. And I think it was an instant, like, I need this on my wall, regardless of what I think of the film. So yeah, I feel like I remember the first image release more because that filled me with more like trepidation than the poster did. Because it's obviously a lovely poster, but
yeah. Well, that's quite a way in the future at this point, because that's all they released before the film was hit Japanese cinemas in July 2023. There was a lot of chat, lots of speculation, particularly from people wondering how the film would be released. Jake, you and I definitely had lots of people saying, surely it's going to play Cannes, it's going to have a premiere at Cannes. And we were always saying, well, actually, they've never world premiered a film, a Miyazaki film, at a festival before its Japanese release. so that'd be very unlikely. And that all these milestones in the film year passed without any word of Ghibli showing up. And they held firm to that Japanese release date, complete blackout on the marketing front. No key stills or imagery from the film, no official movie pamphlet, no trailer. And I remember even seeing tweets from friends at the show and Japanese people I follow on social media saying that they didn't even release the tickets that early. You know how it's kind of standard now for pre-sales to go on sale like a month beforehand if it's a Marvel movie or whatever. They were like really waiting for like 5 days beforehand, a week beforehand to book their tickets. They really wanted to make it feel, I guess, like the old days where you'd be queuing around the block to actually see a blockbuster. An absolutely wild strategy, and I guess a wise one, because anime blockbusters now are quite common in Japan. It used to be that only Ghibli films made massive amounts of money, but in the last few years we've had Demon Slayer, One Piece Red, Suzume, the first Slam Dunk, Jujutsu Kaisen, Zero. They were all huge hits at the Japanese box office in those years when Miyazaki was working away. And I suppose one thing Ghibli has over those films are name recognition. So Studio Ghibli, hi Miyazaki, let's just put the film into cinemas on the strength of those names. And God, I find this so wild. Like, who could do this? Who could release a film not even knowing what it's about? So even that synopsis, Steph, that you read, they didn't even see that synopsis, did they? I think they just saw the new film from Hayao Miyazaki. So no synopsis, a strange poster that doesn't really give anything away, a title that is a question that isn't even sort of a plotty, suggestive title. I mean, we have in pop music the surprise drop, the Beyoncés and the Taylor Swifts, but I suppose music works differently now because it's just there on your Spotify. They don't need you to go out in the rain to a cinema, pay your money, sit down. It's a bit more passive. So, like, who could do this in cinema, do you think? Is there anybody?
I think in an art house world, and for a smaller audience, there would be things that could do this. I feel like David Lynch would be someone that could be surreptitiously making something and just say it's out on Friday and it's in these cinemas, and lots of people would go and see it. But it wouldn't be like a big commercial success, I don't think. Mm-hmm. This actually made me think of Eyes Wide Shut. And the Eyes Wide Shut, we knew that that is the most drawn-out production process, and the rumours of we are shooting the equivalent of 1 minute a month, and what would go on to still hold the Guinness World Record of the longest production shoot in history, or continuing production shoot. But I remember with Eyes Wide Shut, it had as kind of level pegging on the poster Cruise, Kidman, Kubrick, all in the same font, all in the same size. And that was a kind of marker that I can only think of as like, oh, that's where the director of the film has the same top billing and star power as someone at the level of Tom Cruise or Nicole Kidman. Mm-hmm. And that was a very vague poster and a film that very much didn't really give too much away. So probably the only comparison between Eyes Wide Shut and The Boy and the Heron that's going to be out there.
This is why you come to this podcast. But like, it would be as if he'd released Eyes Wide Shut without anyone knowing Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman were in it, because they didn't even announce the voice cast or the animators or any of the credits before the film came out. So it really is just like,
I suppose that's the magic of animation as well. And that's to go back to The Wizard of Oz, that's the thing that's behind the curtain, is that you can put the animators in the office and no one sees the production. Whereas a live action production, you cannot make a live action film without people knowing about it, because they can see you making it.
They'll be flying drones.
The only like current Hollywood director I could imagine doing that would be like someone like Christopher Nolan, who, I mean, I feel like people always turn up in huge droves for whatever he makes, regardless of whether they fully know what they're getting into. So I feel like he could probably do like a Nolan coming out Friday, and then people would just go to the IMAX to see what it is.
Yeah,
I suppose it's whether they could and whether they'd want to as well, because like, in live action cinema world, people are in love with cinema and they're in love with all of the things around cinema. And I suppose Christopher Nolan, even though he's become a big name, he loves his casts, he loves his actors, he wants to put them front and centre as well in the marketing. Although, yeah, Oppenheimer, I guess, was as close as you could get to. It was just Oppenheimer and then a face, which is Cillian Murphy's face with a big sun, and then Nolan's name as big as that. I suppose that's true. I think about David Bowie and Black Star, which we knew he'd been working on a final album-ish. He put out a single, but everybody was NDA'd, so they couldn't talk about who was working on it and what it was, and then that was surprise dropped to a certain extent, surprise released. Anyway, this strange strategy did work. It was its opening was massive and was bigger than Spirited Away, is what they put in press releases, although I suppose inflation and 20 years passing, what does that actually mean? It didn't really sustain beyond that. I don't think it's cracked even the top 30 highest grossing Japanese films of all time, let alone the top 10. So it's not even troubling some of the minor Ghibli successes. But I suppose they don't have that financial imperative to make money and hit that growth that they might have had in the past. It's been an incredible conversation starter, though, and there's been so much to discover. This weird release means that, like, every detail now is fascinating. You know, the fact that it was made differently. Miyazaki is now very old. He used to have, like, a literal, like, hand on every frame in the film, either animating something himself or touching up the animation. And he can't do that now, so he focused more on the storyboards and the image boards and everything, and he delegated more than ever to the animation director on the project, who is this in this case was Takeshi Honda, whose work we've seen and enjoyed and talked about on this podcast or in various other forms many times before. He worked on Millennium Actress, Evangelion, Jinro, Ghibli films like Tales from Earthsea, From Up on Poppy Hill, and I guess that's a setup that allows a bit more wiggle room for the individual animators to make their mark, because Miyazaki's not there adhering it to a Miyazaki style. And one animator to mention in that regard is a guy called Shinya Ohira, who animates a very important scene or sequence in the film that we might talk about in a bit. He has a very distinctive and much looser expressionistic style compared to what you'd expect from Miyazaki himself. He'd worked on previous Ghibli films before, but he'd also worked on stuff like Red Line, Tech on Kinkreet. He'd worked with Masaki Oasa on Night is Short, Walk on Girl, Lou Over the Wall, Ping Pong, the animation. So, like, he'd worked on, like, the wild, stylized animation, as well as stuff like Miyazaki, who has a sort of coherent worldview that's consistent between every frame. And, of course, we found out that, like, all the all-stars came back to help out Miyazaki. Once you actually dig into the credits, you see Kazuo Oga, art director, Katsuya Kondo. Hiromasa Yonebayashi comes back into the fold after going to Ponoc. Masashi Ando comes back. Joe Hisaishi's on the score. So, like, even though there's new stuff, there's familiar stuff as well. And following that Japanese release, things become a bit more conventional after that. As you say, Steph, the stills come out. We do get a trailer. We get an English language title, The Boy and the Heron, which maybe we'll talk about, whether that's a good title or a, you know, a fitting title. It has a bit of a festival rollout, Toronto, San Sebastian, London. That's where we saw it for the first time. And I guess that's where we should leave it. There's so much. We wouldn't often talk about a film before the, you know, usually we'd end on the Oscars and the Academy Awards and all that stuff. But we're here at point of international English language release, and I guess we should talk about it, shouldn't we?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I am very tired from talking. So, Jake and Steph, put us in our shoes back in October, going to see the film. What were we expecting? What did we get?
So we were expecting to see some beautiful animation on screen from the best to ever do it. But I had avoided the trailer. I hadn't actually gone through all of the stills or tried to see anything on social media. I still actually have everything, all the keywords I could think of, muted on Twitter to stop, which I should probably stop now. And so I really was trying to go in as Suzuki intended as much as possible on this. I really didn't know anything about it, like plot-wise at all. And so I was lucky enough to see this film twice during its plays at the London Film Festival. And I suppose the first time watching it was just trying to take it all in from a kind of creative point of view, but from a story point of view as well, because you just really are trying to soak up every detail but also try and follow it along, because we will discuss it's quite a mad narrative that we are sent on. And then second time round, able to settle into the grooves of it and try and understand what it's doing, like what has this film actually got to say, and how is it trying to say it. And it was really, really lovely, because I was really nervous. And I don't know whether you two felt this. We've dedicated a lot of time to this guy. And so as much as I was excited, like, this was like the one film of the year that in any kind of social situation people would talk to me about, because it's like, oh, Jake, he does the Ghibli tech. He writes the books. Oh, what's that film? Oh, what's that about? Talking about. And so there was this almost a kind of burden on us with this film as well, mm-hmm. as not spokespeople, but, you know, there was a kind of onus that we will literally be speaking about it as we are right now. And about an hour into it, I just felt the kind of this weight lift off of me, because I suddenly felt like, he's nailed it. This is amazing. It really is a proper masterpiece. And I do think it's an incredible film. I think it's kind of unwieldy and imaginative, but I do think it's like a perfect film, really, for him to be making at this point in his life. I adore it. From the animation to its philosophy, it's incredible. Steph?
Yeah, I think like you, I was nervous about having to watch it and then immediately think, what are my opinions on this film? What am I going to say? But for the first, yeah, so I saw it at London Film Festival in one of the screenings that they put on, and I just decided, like, I've seen the trailer, it's not giving much away. I'm just going to go into it without my notebook and just enjoy it as somebody who's seeing this film for the first time. Like, I've never seen a new release Studio Ghibli film in the cinema. So I'm just going to go to it as like a film fan, as a Ghibli fan, and just like let it hit me. And then I'll think about notes a bit later. And I think that was a good way to go into it, because yeah, I think, Jake, even if you'd watched the trailer, you wouldn't have spoiled anything for yourself. Like, there's, it's really not giving a lot away once you see it. So I think it was, yeah, good to have like built up the hype for myself and then gone into it just as a bit of a fan, watching it for the first time. But yeah, I am kind of glad I did that, because afterwards I really was not sure about what I thought about it. Like, I knew I really liked it. You can obviously see this is like his masterpiece, his masterwork. But there were, yeah, things within it, in the actual like experience of watching it, that I wasn't necessarily sure about. So I will definitely be back on Boxing Day to watch it again, to like decide for the third time what I think about it. Michael, how was it for you?
I love the fact that we're all nervous, because imagine if like this was his big QAnon anti-vax cancel culture movie telling the kids. No, I guess, yeah, for me, I don't know if I was nervous, because I guess I'm older than you both, and this wasn't the first Ghibli film I'd seen. I guess I'd saw The Wind Rises in a similar way when I saw it in Venice 10 years ago. Even though it'd been out in Japan, this was like its first viewing by the wider world. And this was before the time where we had such a vibrant online community of people who, you know, we knew people who went to Japan and saw it 11 times and then could, you know, write very in-depth essays in the run-up to its international release. I tried to avoid as much of that as possible. But I suppose out of the three of us, I'm a little bit more social media active. And at least in when it comes to Ghibli stuff, and I'm running the Twitter account, so there's only so much that I can ignore all of that. But yeah, I was really overwhelmed by it, because it is, as Jake said, an unwieldy work. There's so much in it. But then also, so much about Miyazaki and Ghibli has been calcified or formalized in the last few years, be it Ghibli vibes, or the way that critics talk about his films, about being a master of the magic in the everyday, a master of not talking down to children in making children's movies. All of these sort of very easy, simple one-liners are bullet points about what his style is. And I'm happy that those things exist, because it makes our job easier to plug into those conversations. But listening back to the podcast over the years, we've found so many contradictions and so many sharp edges and corners within that style, within his worldview, that are fascinating to talk about and unravel. And this film is that completely. It's fascinating, and it should be treated on a level with, I don't know, Silence, Martin Scorsese, a great personal epic that is very much meditating on pet themes. I have a feeling that this film is already being, I don't want to say undermined or pigeonholed, but you can read reviews where it's like, and of course the animation is amazing, and it's Miyazaki with these themes and those themes, as opposed to being wrestled with and think pieced and so many essays dedicated to it, which I think is important, because it is, there's so much in it. What he's doing differently, how he's looking back at the past, looking forward to the future. I've had conversations with people which sees this not so much as a swan song or a final statement, but a clearing of the decks to look ahead to a new future. There are so many different ways to talk about it, and this is why I suppose we need to have our hour-long spoilery one where we ask all these questions and speculate, because this already, it's very easy to get away from what the film actually is. And I suppose let's go back to what the film actually is, because one thing I will say is it's fantastic, and it has, and I think I like it more than many of his other films, and it works in a way that some of his supposed best films haven't worked for me. That sense that he makes the films in chunks, and it may take turns, or what it may be about for the first 20 minutes it's not about that for another further hour, and then it comes back to being about that at the end. There are so many interlocking and interweaving lines of how to read the film and enjoy the film, that on that first view, particularly this unique experience of knowing nothing, you're on full sensory overload, right? Because you're seeing characters for the first time. At least if you're going into Eyes Wide Shut, you know, you'll see, you know, you're going to see Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman in some sense, but you're like, I've not even seen these characters before, these creations or anything. So it's quite overwhelming in that sense. But where should we start, I suppose, when we're talking about it? What we do on this podcast is because we went through these films one by one. It's what's different, what's new, what's familiar, what's surprising. And I suppose, should we go with the surprising stuff first?
Sure.
In the story, the tone, the vibes?
Well, we've got our first kind of young male protagonist, I suppose, which is quite different.
Well, I know, older than the lad in Ponyo.
Yeah.
I suppose.
But he is very much like the central character, where I would say like in Castle in the Sky or in Ponyo, you've got a kind of shared protagonist there. And I think that's very intentional because we are, like, this film is kind of working on cyclical time, and that they are characters in here that need to reflect kind of people in reality, or at least that's what I think, at young ages and much older ages. And it even says in the blurb it's semi-autobiographical. And so I think we can see Mojito as this mirror for Miyazaki. And so, see, that's very different to what we've seen before, just from a character point of view. But from a animation point of view, there is that expressionistic, that's the word that you mentioned, Michael. There's stuff going on here that we've never seen before. And the opening, and I think you do see this in the trailer, that they are, Mojito and his dad are leaving Tokyo to the countryside, escaping fires and the war. And that fire, as it sweeps across Tokyo and ultimately burns up the hospital his mother works in and takes her life, that fire is done in a way that's perhaps most reminiscent of Kaguya's escape from Tale of Princess Kaguya, but then mixed with the firebombing of Grave of the Fireflies. And so we talked about in the Wind Rises episode that from a narrative point of view, The Wind Rises is his most Takahata film. But stylistically, he's really pulling from the Giant Sloth now. And we think about Miyazaki, even though it is this explosion of creativity, he is kind of locked into a house style, even when he's doing amazing things with it. And seeing this so early on in the film, it's within the first couple of minutes you see this, and it looks like celluloid being burnt. Like, it warps in the picture. Like, these faces kind of bulge and burn away. It's really quite horrible. And to show you that early on, you think, oh, wow, it's amazing. He is excited and intrigued by new ways of approaching this and what he can do with animation. And so it's just this nice calling card at the beginning to tell you that you don't really know what to expect, story-wise, but also formally as well.
And that is the Shinya Ohira sequence. And that is, I think, reading that he worked on so many Masaki Yuasa projects kind of unlocked something for me, that is almost like having a little bit of a Yuasa-type film, but within the framework of a very serious, dramatic, thrilling Miyazaki film, something that's looser than you'd ever seen before, but it's following the emotion of a scene and letting it warp in the way that Takahata loved to do in his later films, trying to bring the intentionality of the line or the animator's pen through in the final work. Really astonishing stuff, for sure.
I think beyond that, there's a real surprise in the structure of it. I think you mentioned like something with like Spirited Away, which does just kind of expand and expand and expand exponentially from a story point of view until it can't really go anywhere and they quickly have to solve it. This feels beautifully structured in the point that it does get kind of more abstract as it goes along, but it finds a great kind of end point and then gets out really quickly. But that the first third of the film, which has Mojito at this country home kind of trying to deal with the death of his mother, the fact that his new quote-unquote mother is his mother's sister, and so they look exactly the same. So it's this strange feeling of grief, and it's like haunting where he's having to see this doppelganger at all times. And it's a very strange house that's made up of multiple buildings. And you have this like Greek chorus of old women that follow him around. And this is really slow. And it's almost, 40 minutes, 45 minutes? And there's really, and I only really noticed this on the second time watching it, there's not a lot of dialogue. Like, there's really, really not a lot of talking in the whole film up until the point that they enter the other world. And I think like that's, which we're showing how confident he is in the animation and how much trust he's got in the audience to be patient, that we're just going to experience this world and all the details of this world and just watch the heron fly around. And the heron is amazing because it moves so slowly. Like, the wing beats sound like propellers on like a wind turbine. Like, they just like have this slow thud to them. And you have just all this time observing this world. It's quite amazing.
I think there's, you said like there's not a lot of dialogue in that section, but I feel like he's doing so much with the animation of each set of characters in that area. So like Mahito and his aunt and his father, and then the group of old women, and then the heron. You have these three different kind of styles or sections all kind of going together. This was, I think, my favorite section of the film. Not saying that I don't like the rest, because I definitely do, but I think that kind of almost like slice of life style that's going on in the first kind of 40 minutes, where he's just in this countryside house and you're just, yeah, it's very focused on, you know, making all of those details of like, how would Mahito get dressed like a real person? Like, that's animated so well. But then you have these like old ladies who are slightly, they don't look the same as the other like human characters. They're kind of like squished down to like this weird size, and they're lumpy but they're wired, and they all have these amazing walk cycles where one of them's just doing this lovely little arm motion while she's walking. And there's kind of loads of these weird little details, but yeah, I love all of that kind of focus on like the human side before we get into this absolutely mad world later on. And it elicited so many laughs that first kind of 40 minutes, even from like the heron like squeezing in through a window head first and struggling to like fit. Just people were giggling all over the room.
Yeah, there's so much to enjoy in this film. It's so delightful, and not necessarily in that way that where it's you know, cozy. It's just really funny in the details, and that's while it's also quite heavy in the themes. Like, it starts off from a point of grief. It's in this wartime situation. He's evacuated, you know, out to the country. It's very similar to something like Narnia in that sense, the tradition of British evacuation stories. But and within that, you have survivor guilt, you have middle class guilt and shame, because he's a middle class boy in this very rural area where all the other kids are being conscripted into being voluntary agricultural workers. But then at the same time, the opening bit is where he's just being badgered by this really weird heron that seems to lord it over the estate in various forms. And yeah, I love the old women. There's like even just that one shot, as you say, the walk cycle step, it's just one shot of them walking from one side of the screen to the other through the house, and we, you know, it doubles the canon of amazing old ladies in Miyazaki movies. Howl's Moving Castle and Spirited Away have given us many in the past, as did Ponyo, but this is something else. And then yeah, it then takes that turn into fantasy world. And I saw reviews saying, and then Miyazaki was on more home turf at that point. I don't know, what do you guys think about the latter half of the film?
I mean, there's so much here that we've never seen him do before. I don't know how this is home turf. It's home turf in that it's not reality, I guess. But he's doing lots of, like, there's stuff that you can draw kind of familiar lines between them. Like, there is imagery here of ships that I think recalls the imagery of planes in Porco Rosso in a kind of spiritual sense. But I think that's kind of reductive to think of him as almost like treating him in fantasy as its own genre. Like, it just becomes another playground for him. And there are sequences here that are entirely different, but also from a storytelling point of view, he gives himself the freedom that nothing really needs to make sense or connect, and it's a bit more lucid and scenes can take place in one setting and immediately move into another that is moves from a kind of natural forest-like setting into more of a, I don't know, a classical Roman hall, but they seem to be next to each other. And it feels more expressionistic in that respect. It's all, every scene is about maximizing the impact in that moment, and that we're given the trust to connect them and follow the character through these spaces. And it does more, it's more of a dream space than Spirited Away in that respect, because Spirited Away at least has a kind of continuity within the bathhouse space, I suppose, whereas this can go anywhere in any direction, and it makes it so exciting. But I think, like, this idea of, so this ship, there is an island that is the shape of a ship, and there are all these ships floating around, and to me that's like, that's really key, because I think this is a film that's all set in transitory spaces. Everything is about movement, and it's moving from one thing to the next thing to the next thing, and viewing this as a story about mortality and a story about grief, that everything here is all about movement, whether that is characters moving from one setting to another or the settings themselves. And like, you can see that in his approach to it. He wants to constantly keep you guessing and keep you excited about what the next place might be.
I guess the kind of whoever's saying that he's on familiar turf with this, like if you've seen Spirited Away recently before you've seen this, that might feel like a kind of an apt description of the second half of the film. But I think it definitely has elements of that, of being just dragged through this fantasy world. There's lots of rules you have to pick up along with the character, and you're greeted with a new bizarre character design and interesting thing like every kind of 5 minutes. But I think it's just operating on like a whole other level with this overarching set of themes constantly kind of feeding into whatever crazy adventure you're on in that moment.
Yeah, because I think that within Spirited Away, and we've said on the podcast before that we think that that film has a lumpy structure, or a strange structure to it storytelling wise. This film does become quite episodic. It made me think a lot of the Earthsea novels, and I know that it's that sort of influence on Miyazaki is quite overstated, in the sense that to be very, very reductive about sci-fi and fantasy novels, you either have the 1,000-page one that explains every rule of the world and you learn everything, or you have the 300-page ones, which leaves a lot to the imagination but is more episodic, discovering character and places. This is more like the latter kind, where Mahito is journeying through this space, discovering things, then moving on to something else. But there is this overarching structure to it, this sense of the granduncle character, this mysterious, disappeared, you know, elusive character who holds some sway over the family, over the estate, and then this strange tower that he built then disappeared into. So we know where we're going. We have the journey. So it means that we can vibe out with all of these moments, and some of them are just so wonderful. There is a sequence with the cute breakout characters of the film, the Wara Wara, where just in the space of maybe a 15-minute sequence, we are delivered a lot of evocative lore for these characters, I suppose, and what they are, what they represent. But really, it's just a nighttime ballet of seeing them fly in the sky with some really wonderful Joe Hisaishi music. And Jake, you said this is quite minimal in terms of dialogue, this film, but listening back to the soundtrack is all these perfect miniature cues all the way through. They're 2 or 3 minutes long. There's not that much music either in the film, but what is there is just perfectly formed.
Yeah, it's an incredible score. We said in our Joe Hisaishi concert episode that we were teased a piece of music, and gosh, anytime it appears in this, it's so powerful, and it's so sparse in that respect, but in a way that makes it more direct, and it feels so connected to this character and this experience. And it feels like we were so lucky of seeing Joe play that and seeing the emotion that he felt playing it, and I couldn't help connect that to my experience watching it and hearing those notes.
So this, as we said, is a bit of a spoiler light tread through the film. We're going to go deeper next time. But is there anything else we can dance around or mention for listeners on their first view of the film?
Well, that idea of it being a message to his grandson, I think, is really fascinating. And I think there absolutely is a message of the film in that specific nature of grief, where it is a communication from one generation to another generation in a kind of familial line. And that absolutely works. But I kind of think this is also a message to Ghibli fans, animation fans, in a way. And I think see how you get on with it, because once it rolls into its final 20 minutes or so and the grand uncle becomes more of a key character in the film, it gets into such fascinating territory, which I absolutely love. We will could go on for hours about in our spoiler episode.
I don't want to say anything without being spoilery, but certain characters that I think people should watch out for to enjoy are certain types of birds. I think we see some parakeets in the trailer. Enjoy those. And also Mahito's dad, I think, is a lesser seen but MVP character in the film. He's great.
Yeah,
brilliant. And a surprise Ghibli dad compared to what we might expect of Ghibli. Also, shout out to an amazing bit of butter and jam on bread. An incredible food moment.
I think that leads into something I want to say. I think that, look at how this is, I think, his funniest film. I think it's his grossest film. I think that it's his least cozy film.
It's his scariest film.
Mm-hmm.
Scariest film. So there's a lot of themes and emotions and experiences in this film that I think are new and different and very fascinating for somebody who's been on the Ghibli Attack journey like we have, and looking at everything that's happened before and how what's different here. But it is the weight of legacy, what we take from others, what we get from others, what others give to us, and then how we live with all those things, all those influences on our personalities and our characters. So gosh, we'll go deeper next time, but The Boy and the Heron, everybody. It's been a long time since we've had to put a Ghibli film into our rankings. I don't think we should really try and put it on an actual number, but the one question I want to ask is, Steph, what would your ranking be called? Did we ever give it a title?
Ooh. I don't think we ever did, because I don't think I've ever done one, and I haven't done one for this either. So maybe what's the list?
The what's list?
Let's go with that for now.
But I guess if we're talking about tiers, is this top tier, middle tier, lower tier? Because I think this is definitely top tier for me. I think that this definitely deserves to rank alongside my favorite of his works, and in a different, you know, it resounds to me in a different way to many of his works. I loved that essayistic feeling of The Wind Rises. It's something that you can wrestle with and find new depth in. That's definitely here, but it's also such a great statement of intent within animation, within storytelling. Definitely up there for me.
I mean, yeah, I agree. This is just top tier for me.
Oh yeah, it's top tier for me, for sure. Yeah.
Usually we'd have this in the context, but we would be talking about its Academy Award run. This has not happened yet. Do we fancy its chances? The big question. I'm going to run through what it's up against this year, because it's quite a stacked field for animation, best animated feature. It's up against Elemental and Wish. It's up against Across the Spider-Verse, Trolls Band Together, Super Mario Brothers Movie. I mean, they're the massive major studio type films. Then in the sort of slightly more artistic realm, we have Chicken Run 2, new Aardman film. We have Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, Nimona, Robot Dreams. I mean, we can't really rely on the award bodies to do the right thing, can we? I can easily see them just giving it all to major studios this year, all the nomination spots. Do you think it'll slip through?
I'd love for it to get in. I'd love for it to win. I feel like the popular vote is probably Spider-Verse, but I'd like that they would just hold off on giving it to Spider-Verse until that film has a sequel, that they can just give it to them as a kind of pat on the back for both. I'd love Mutant Mayhem to get nominated. I'd love Robot Dreams to get nominated. I think the first five you mentioned, Elemental, Wish, Spider-Verse, Super Mario and Trolls, I'd be happy for none of those to get nominated.
Yeah, I think there's the dream category, which is all of the stuff that's actually really good and really vibrant and shows a bright future for animation, and hopefully this could be in the mix of them. I think what's dinging it a little bit is it's not really a family film. Mm. It's a PG-13. Is it PG-13? It's definitely a 12A here. So it's not put your kids in front of Totoro for an hour and see their eyes light up. Mm. It's certainly a bit more, if not grown up, then a bit more challenging. But not challenging in a way that a animated look at the life of a artist or Holocaust survivor or something, you know, whatever, you know, it's not a themes movie, an obvious themes historical movie that the Academy usually goes for. So we'll have to see how that fares. But I guess our time has run out for the standard spoiler light episode of The Boy and the Heron. We've got to go back to the real world of our lives and leave behind a world of fantasy. So we will be back. We've already got a running list of bullet points and questions. I have the Art of Boy and the Heron book for us to go through and get a bit deeper into the film. But that's our take on the film to begin with. So we'll be back with that episode shortly. And listeners, if you do see the film over December and have thoughts to send in, please send them in to us. We are ghibliattack@gmail.com. Find us on social media. Find us on Patreon, patreon.com/ghibliattack, where we have our Library Cafe episodes. We're over on Twitter @ghibliattack, Instagram, ghibliattack.pod. We're also all there individually on social media. Jake is there on Twitter, Jake H. Cunningham, Instagram, jake.h.cunningham.
Steph's on x/Twitter @_StephWatts.
And Michael is on x/Twitter @MichaelJLeader and on Instagram @Michael.Leader. Ghibliotech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShiel and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ng.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.